cliffcentral.com.
All around the world. There we go. It's a little bit of Bebo with Ludacris and All Around the World. Just after 8 o'clock, it's Friday. Stretch and yawn. Lucas, let's bring in Lord Hayne. Let's meet the man and talk to him about all the things that he's done. What an interesting life this man has had. What an extraordinary, extraordinary life. And little known fact is he spent a vast part of his life here in South Africa. He was actually born in Africa, ended up becoming a member of parliament, ended up becoming a member of the cabinet of Tony Blair and of Gordon Brown, and was even in the Labour Party up to the point where Ed Miliband was the leader. So we've got an interesting range of historical facts and things to talk to him about. His involvement with South Africa isn't just surface, though. He was very much an anti-apartheid campaigner for a long time during his life here in South Africa and once he'd moved to the UK. What an interesting chap, and thank you so much for coming in to see us. The Right Honourable the Lord Hayne. Good morning.
Morning.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good. It's nice to see you. And I don't know what brings you to South Africa, but you obviously come here as often as you can, and you've got a long-standing relationship with all of us here in the southern tip of Africa.
Yes, I'm back here as a visiting professor at Wits Business School.
Oh, excellent.
That's the reason for my...
All right.
Why I'm sitting opposite you in the studio, and thank you for having me on.
Sure, what a pleasure. Can we begin with... I mentioned earlier you've had this amazing life and this interesting life where you've spoken to such diverse people. I was reading a biography of yours not so long ago online, told the story of your relationship with Tariq Aziz back in Iraq during that very fractious time. But there's a lot of stuff that we can cover this morning. Maybe we should begin... At the beginning, you're actually an African. You were born here. You were born in Kenya.
Yes. My parents were South Africans, South African born. My mum from Port Alfred. My dad from Durban. And when my dad graduated as an architect from Wits University in 1949, his first job was in Nairobi. And by that stage, my mum was pregnant with me. So they flew up on an old Dakota to Nairobi, and a few months later I arrived. And then we were only there for under a year. And so the fact that I was born in Nairobi is kind of...
It's almost coincidental.
It's in transit, as it were. And then my entire childhood was in South Africa, in Pietermaritzburg, Ladysmith, but mostly in Pretoria.
So how did you, at that stage... imagine that your life would unfold? I mean, in South Africa, the last thing you expect to be doing is you expect nothing like ending up in the cabinet of a prime minister in Britain. This wasn't something
definitely
that
not
thought might happen. So what did you want to be? Were you studying to be a lawyer? Were you interested in, because you clearly have a real pull towards human rights issues, social justice issues. These are the things that turn you on. I mean, were you already at a young age interested in those things?
Well, I was like any other young South African boy. I was mad keen on sport, cricket, but above all soccer, and motor racing. My dad used to take me to watch motor racing at Grand Central and then at Kyalami, and used to go and watch the 9-hour race in the early 60s overnight. So it was actually very exciting. So that was my kind of normal side of my childhood. I was at Pretoria Boys High, and before that at Hatfield Primary School in Pretoria. And but the key thing was my mom and dad, who were an ordinary South African couple, there was no political background in them at all, then became very involved, increasingly involved in the anti-apartheid struggle in Pretoria. Most of the action was in people like Joe Slovo and Ruth First, the iconic names of the anti-apartheid struggle, people like Hugh Lewin as well, for example, who was a good family friend. They were all Joburg-based. That was where the kind of metropolitan action were. Nelson Mandela, of course, when he left the Transkei, Walter Sisulu and the others, they all went to Joburg. So Pretoria was a bit of a kind of isolated enclave in a very heavily apartheid-dominated city.
Sure.
And my mom and dad, therefore, found themselves becoming the chief anti-apartheid activists, particularly her.
In Pretoria.
In Pretoria. They were members of the South African Liberal Party. But it was the Communist Party, the Congress of Democrats were not really very active, if at all, in Pretoria. So they found themselves as the main activists amongst the white.
A lightning rod in the middle of this very...
Yeah, and, you know, a multiracial party. They worked closely with the ANC in the townships of Mamelodi and Attridgeville and so on.
And in those days, that was dangerous.
It was very dangerous. One of my first memories was as an 11-year-old being woken up in the early hours of the morning and told my mum and dad had been arrested. Part of their support for Nelson Mandela's call for the Defiance campaign. And they were distributing leaflets in the townships around Pretoria, at least that was the plan. Mm-hmm. And then mum continued to be active. It was an ironic incident when the Minister for Police was depicted in a cartoon in the Star newspaper, the Star newspaper, which is of course still published, and it said to one of his underlings, had him pictured, "Go and find Adelaine Hayne, my mum, check what she's doing, and tell her she mustn't." So there was an Orwellian kind of.
But that's quite something. I mean, you have to be an activist of a certain kind to become the subject of a cartoon.
You do, yes.
So she must have really bristled a lot of these people in the upper echelons of the National Party.
She did, and they were prolific letter writers, my mum and dad. My dad used to write leader page articles for the Star, but mainly for the Rand Daily Mail, which was the main critical paper against apartheid then. And a little after that cartoon, my mum got a letter warning her that she must not continue with what was called communist-related activities. Well, they were not communists. They were liberals. No,
it's like that McCarthy nonsense in America, that there was just such paranoia.
Absolutely. It was, you know, the height of the Cold War. And, of course, the apartheid rulers played on all of that to try and frighten people.
Yeah, the difference here is that these people were in government and they had the tools at their disposal to really make your life very difficult and dangerous and possibly even take you out.
Which is what they did to a lot of people. I mean, yeah, they made our life so difficult that we had to leave the country.
I mean, Ruth, but first, we still know the story.
We do. Yeah. And you know, a lot of people just disappeared. A lot of people got tortured. A lot of people got assassinated. In my mom's case, she then got banned and issued with a banning order. Now, that was prohibited her from taking part in political activity, which is its main objective.
How old were you at this stage?
I was 13 when she was banned.
How did you interpret all of this? Because most children's mothers, I suppose, are primarily concerned with raising them. And I'm not saying that your mother wasn't, but it must have been an additional characteristic of your mother that she was constantly involved in these very public episodes, which for a 13-year-old is tough to deal with. It could either have really embarrassed you or made you very proud, but either way, it wasn't normal.
It certainly wasn't normal. I mean, I was the only one of my school friends, but my mom and my dad were exceptional parents. So we used to have bike races, for example, in our garden, and half the school would come to, and my mum and dad would act as marshals. So they were doing that kind of normal thing. My dad would teach bowl at me at cricket, and he'd come to watch me at cricket or at when I played rugby or at football, at soccer. And my mum was a great mother, but she was hyperactive as well. It was exceptional, and fantastic parents, best parents I think in the world, but then I think all kids say that. Anyway, they banned my mom. It restricted her, it stopped her doing anything openly, though she continued covertly. And there were a number of clauses in a banning order. They were not, you're not able to go on educational premises, so she couldn't come and discuss our progress at school with our teachers, myself and my younger brother and two sisters. And then one of the many other clauses in the banning order was that you cannot communicate with another banned person, which is designed to also crush the opposition. That created a huge dilemma for the government when they banned my dad a year after her.
Oh, God, because then they live in the same house. And
well, they're a married couple.
Yeah.
And they'd never banned a married couple before. So they had to insert special clauses in their banning orders, a new clause in my dad's new banning order, an addendum to my mum's, which I remember Burley Special Branch man presenting at the front door, allowing them each exceptional permission to communicate with one other banned person, namely each other.
Can you imagine these apparatchiks running around trying to make this law?
That was what apartheid was like.
Ridiculous.
You remember the Population Registration Act had that extraordinary clause trying to define whiteness as opposed to...
Yes, the pencil test and all of that stuff.
Yeah, but it was, you know, it was extraordinary, Orwellian kind of amazing stuff. But that was the kind of the ideology of apartheid, and then underneath it was this very vicious, brutal police state, which our family were victims of, but nothing like victims compared with many, many people who disappeared, were killed, or tortured.
So you kind of grew up in this cauldron of very real, very personal politics.
Yes, and it was, I mean, I was always very proud of my mum and dad. I thought they were amazing, and they were amazing parents, as I said. So we had this normal childhood, sport, and parents coming to watch you. Well, they couldn't come onto the school premises after they were banned, and my dad used to watch from over the school fence when I played cricket on one of the pitches near at Pretoria Boys High. In fact, I went back to have a look at it and show a film crew following me exactly where it happened. So there was this normality, and then there was this abnormality of police raids, of special branch cars parked outside the front gate, following us wherever we went, sometimes chasing us. My mom once discovered that a friend, a fellow activist, was going to be arrested, she heard through the grapevine. So we piled us into the car, she rushed out, special branch tailing us, she pulled up at some stoplights, indicating to go right, with them right behind us, and then she suddenly jumped the lights and turned left and lost them and managed to get to his house to warn him, and he left that night from the airport.
It's a bit James Bond.
It was a bit James Bondish, but it was an element of exciting, a bit of cops and robbers stuff as well.
And she managed to get to him and warn him because, of course, in those days, she couldn't have used the landline phone.
No, because they were all tapped.
And we didn't have cell phones, so she had to actually get in her car and go there.
Indeed.
God.
And on another occasion, a prisoner escaped, active in the struggle, and my mum got a phone call sort of saying to her roughly what had happened, but our phone was tapped, so she had to go really fast. And anyway, to cut a long story short, he arrived late at night outside our house, which was in a place called The Willows, which was a little beyond Lynnwood in Pretoria.
Must have still been quite agricultural then.
It was, actually. Yeah. It was set on a little koppie, thatched properties, rondavels. And it was a great place to be brought up. And he came via a neighbor's house, this escaped African prisoner, a member of the Pan-Africanist Congress. And he came through the neighbor's house with special branch down the front. My dad went through the bush to find him, and he slept overnight in the servants' quarters. And then they put him in the boot and drove him out the next day, and he escaped over the border. So all that sort of thing was going on. And then eventually the authorities issued an instruction. The banning order confines you to your municipal area. Yeah. That's what it did. Right. You couldn't leave that without permission, and that was usually never granted. So he was confined to Pretoria. He's an architect. He designed hospital laboratories, but, you know, an architect generally. And they basically issued an instruction to every architectural firm, including, obviously, the council, Pretoria City Council, that they couldn't employ him. So we were deprived of a livelihood, and he managed to get a job in London, and the family left penniless, had nothing, friends raised the money. And we went to London and started a new life. And I always think, you know, people have often said, and we'll no doubt discuss this, about my anti-apartheid activity in stopping racist white South African sports tours.
The Stop 70 Tour.
Stop the 70 right. Tour stuff. Always say, you know, you made a major contribution and so on, and showed a lot of courage. And that's very nice of people to say. But actually, my mum and dad were the ones who sacrificed everything.
Had
to start again. They gave up the country. They didn't want to. None of us wanted to leave. They gave up the country they loved. They didn't want to desert those fellow activists who were involved in the struggle. They felt they were betraying them, but they had no option. Couldn't earn a living.
If we fast forward a little bit, and we can come back in a moment, but when 1990 rolls around and the ANC are unbanned and Nelson Mandela's released and all of this stuff, it must have been some sort of Pyrrhic victory, because while you have nothing to show for it in terms of anything gained for you personally, you and your family. There's this freedom that's dawned on South Africa, or at that stage, at least the promise of freedom.
Yep.
And that at least you were on the right side of history, which is kind of a nice place to be when you've had your whole life turned upside down.
I don't think it was in any sense a Pyrrhic victory. It was a feeling of absolute miraculous joy.
Okay.
When we watched, I watched him walk into freedom, Nelson Mandela walk into freedom from Victor Verster prison.
But you being removed from it now, it almost must have felt like you wanted to be there, I'm sure.
No, I didn't think we felt that, because had to start a new life. I mean, yeah. My mom and dad told us, I think very wisely, because exile is a terribly hard thing for people, and a lot of exiled families, white and black, had a very tough time. Mm. The children especially, a close friend of mine, a brilliant guy, actually my same age, you know, a top cricketer, brilliant at school, actually committed suicide within 18 months of getting to London. People broke down, had mental problems, alcoholism, all of that kind of thing. My mum and dad said to us, we're never going back.
Yeah.
We're starting a new life.
So when
Mandela walked out, it was just, you know, there were tears flooding, a sense of achievement. And I think all the anti-apartheid activists in Britain, where there's a very active campaigning organization, just felt, wow, we've won.
Right.
And that doesn't happen very often to protest campaigns.
And also these things are sometimes so drawn out that by the time you get to having realized that you've won, there isn't really as much euphoria as there might have been at the time that you started the struggle. For you, though, with all these campaigns against the tours to South Africa, and there was a very real goal in mind from the beginning for you. You needed to bring about the destruction of this state.
Yes, and it was a few years. I mean, I was 16 when I left, and by 19, I found myself unexpectedly, and this is part of the story of my life, into the cabinet and all the rest of it, never expecting things to happen. I found myself leading the campaign, and I suppose that was right in a way, though I'd never expected it. I thought I'd be a sort of foot soldier in it, because I came up with the idea of physically stopping the matches. This was a period in the late 1960s of student sit-ins in America and Britain, the Paris student revolt of 1968, a very exciting time to come in and sort of get involved in youth politics, as I was then in my late teens. And there was all this going, and then suddenly the Springbok tour was coming, and it was on the back of the exclusion of Basil D'Oliveira. Remember the Cape Coloured cricketer who had to play for England? The England cricket team was touring South Africa, and he was part of it. And Foster said, this is the team of the anti-apartheid movement, and stopped it. And even after that, the cricket authorities issued an invitation to white South Africa to tour England.
Yeah,
and I felt really kind of...
Doesn't it sound bizarre now when you think
yes.
he called it the team of the anti-apartheid movement? And he banned them?
Because they contained a coloured South African.
It's outrageous now.
Well, it was. But what it did is it really annoyed me. And I thought, right, I'm going to do something about this. And nobody had run onto pitches before. Nobody had disrupted the matches. They'd stood with placards outside. And I thought, right, we're going to apply the same tactics of non-violent direct action that had been used in the Paris student revolt and so on, as I described, to apartheid sport. And that's what we did. And we disrupted the 25-match Springbok tour. We did all sorts of things. We booked we ran onto the pitch. You know, there was mayhem right across the country. And we also booked a young woman activist into the Springbok Hotel in Park Lane in Piccadilly the night before the international against England. And she discovered where the box was staying. And injected solidifying agent into the door locks. And so when they tried to get out the next morning, they had to kind of literally force the doors. And then we persuaded the driver of their coach, with its engine idling, waiting to take them to the match, to go in and talk to the management. And our guy got into the driver's seat, drove the coach off, crashed it, and chained himself to the driving wheel. And so, you know, had that caused mayhem. So the books arrived late on, not for the match, but, you know, on
terms
of
the Were you ever arrested for any of this?
I was arrested a number of times, but actually never charged. I was dragged off Twickenham a number of times and various other cricket fields of England.
I suppose there are a lot of people in South Africa who are quite grateful for this when you sit down and talk to them and they realize what a role you played. But a lot of white South Africans are probably oblivious to it because it would have only been something they were aware of if they suddenly had their favorite sports event interrupted. For black South Africans, it might even be a revelation because they had no information coming in from the outside very often.
Well, first of all, on white South Africans, one of the reasons I targeted sports apartheid because I was a South African boy. I was a sports fanatic.
You knew what I knew. The soft spots were.
I knew that, you know, remember, South Africa under apartheid was regarded as a pariah of the world.
Yes.
Politically and so on. But then they were welcomed as equals, given lavish hospitality at Twickenham, at Murrayfield, at in Cardiff and so on. And so it was a great source of comfort and morale boost that these tours were. And, of course, the Springboks touring and the mighty Springboks, not so mighty today, sadly, but they were then. So when I remember Nelson Mandela telling me when he came out and I met him for the first time, my mom and dad had met him first in the late 1950s. He's telling me that when they were on Robben Island, they had a news blackout at this time in 1969-70. This was a grim time in the process of struggle because the leadership was all imprisoned, the resistance had been closed down, and that was remaining until the Soweto uprising in 1976. And he told me that in this news blackout, the one bit of news they got was about the sports boycott, the demonstrations. Why? Because their white warders on Robben Island, fanatical
sports fans. Yeah.
Badly educated, pretty violent, not very nice guys. But they were so frustrated and furious, they vented their fury on Mandela and his colleagues. And one of our close family friends, Hugh Lewin, who I've been visiting the last few days, was serving in Pretoria, imprisonment for political activities. He had the same experience. And these warders vented their blaming inmates, like political prisoners like Nelson Mandela, for these demonstrations if they had orchestrated. Well, they knew nothing about them.
Yeah.
And in Hugh Lewin's case, he heard the name Peter Hayne. Well, he'd been active with my parents, and he'd met me as a young boy. So they felt, Mandela said, they felt, you know, a tremendous boost to know that this was causing such mayhem. And then to just round it off, in terms of, so white South Africans hated me, absolutely hated me at the time. Some still do, but, you know, lots of moving things have happened. People who said they hated me at the time have said, now I understand why you did what you did. Black South Africans, on the other hand, who knew about it, were really supportive and will still tell me so of that generation. But, you know, younger people don't remember that. Yeah. And so this is really an elder generation of people.
This is the thing that frustrates me. I'm a student of history, so I care about the context for these things. Mm. And I find that too often we like to see the struggle against apartheid as being a very monolithic thing. There were a lot of people from various places, various backgrounds, various races, various countries that all got together because they felt that there was an egregious wrong going on. And they stood together in this very hodgepodge collection of people who often organized themselves very well,
yes,
but often weren't really organized. They just had in common this idea that something needed to be done.
Yes.
And when you hear the individual stories, they're tremendously moving when you bother to read them. And history is, unfortunately, it's there to be read, but very few people go in and bother to read it. So when you hear about the struggle and you hear that it's largely been assumed by the current, you know, the incumbent ANC in government as being only their inheritance. They leave out the SACP, they leave out the PAC, they don't talk about the foreign activists who did so much, they don't talk about exiled South Africans quite as much. Do you feel that somehow they're not telling the full story? Because they're keeping it simple because they know people don't bother to read.
Yeah, I'm not sure this is a deliberate conspiracy on anybody's part inside the ANC or anywhere
else. There's a lot of political capital in being the liberator.
Yes,
in South Africa,
and claiming the exclusive struggle sort of heroics.
Mm.
I mean, the ANC was the principal liberation movement.
Sure.
Nobody would dispute
absolutely.
That. Absolutely. But there was a lot of sacrifices were made by a lot of brave white activists. My parents included people like Hugh Lewin, people like Joe Slobo, Bram Fischer, Ruth Thurston, and many, many others. And actually, Nelson Mandela was always the first to acknowledge that.
Yeah.
He made the point that... And this is true.
Even people like Robert Sobukwe, who nobody refers to him much anymore. The PAC have tried to sort of hold up a flame for him, but even they are they're a minor party in South Africa now.
Yes. I mean, he played a very important role.
Hugely important.
And they at one stage were actually the more militant spearhead of activity. By the way,
he probably had the worst treatment of all on Robben Island.
Yes, absolutely.
Complete isolation.
Yes.
Oh.
He suffered terribly. And there was a moving... A young PAC activist, a moving episode, which I'll just briefly describe, if I may, Gareth, of a young PAC activist found himself on trial in Pretoria and subsequently sentenced to 10 years on Robben Island. And my mom, who used to go around the courts, much to the anger of the white court officials and the police, to help young defendants be connected to their parents, because sometimes they just disappear and their parents never knew and the police wouldn't tell the parents. And she used to do this and was known about it, and she thinks that's the main reason she was banned. And there was this young boy, 15 years old, in short pants, being tried for potentially his life, just for protesting. And she used to take him food every day, soup and chocolate. She discovered he loved chocolate. You know who she was?
Mm-hmm.
We never discovered this until 5 years ago by a process of almost accident and coincidence. He was Deputy Chief Justice Dikgang Moseneke.
Really?
He was an amazing man. And he didn't know who she was. And he told me when I met him that it made one of the biggest impressions on his life because he was embittered by his treatment. He thought all whites were like the special branch and the court officials, and he was dispatched to Robben Island as a 15-year-old. But there was this one white woman who stood out. He never knew her. She seemed tiny, he thought, and she is small. And he said, and it's very moving, he said it completely changed his attitude.
You discovered this when?
I discovered this in 2012 when I was making a film for the BBC.
And your mother's still around?
My mother is still around. She's 90 years old. My dad, at the age of nearly 92, died a few months ago.
Sorry. Is there a way that your mother and Dikgang Moseneke could meet?
We've tried to make it happen, but she doesn't really want to travel anymore.
Sure.
And
he might.
He's been to London. He's not been able to come down to Wales where she is. She would love that, but he's quite frail. They've talked on the phone.
Extraordinary. What a story.
And when I met him, she said, right, before you go to South Africa to make this
film,
take some chocolate. He bought some chocolate and I gave it to him.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. So you discovered this by accident, which is,
yes, but what, you know, but your point about there were many others involved I think particularly, it's important for the politics of South Africa at the moment, which is quite volatile, and there's quite a lot of rewriting of history.
Yeah.
For example, Nelson Mandela's role has been criticized as being selling out and all of that.
Yeah.
But what I don't think should be done is to write out from history not only the other African activists, the black activists like the PAC who played an important role, but also the white activists, who, as Nelson Mandela said, has written in The Long Walk to Freedom, they didn't have to do this.
Yeah.
So we had to do it because we were the ones that were being oppressed. Mm. My mom and dad didn't need to do this.
They had a very quiet, placid, happy life, as many white people did.
None of their friends, their school friends, their relatives, none of them did anything like this. And they lost everything, but at least they didn't lose their lives. And then we found ourselves continuing the struggle in London, over the sports campaign. My mum was actually the unofficial secretary of the Stop the Tour campaign. It was run from our tiny flat in London. this vast movement of 100,000 people. It was extraordinary, so, really.
I'm curious about how you go from that to Labour Party politics.
Well, I think, first of all, politics and a passion for promoting justice and equality and human rights was in my DNA from my mum and dad.
Right.
You know, from all those experiences.
Absolutely.
As a boy.
It all makes sense now.
And so politics was in my blood, and I got more and more involved. And to cut a long story short, unexpectedly, my local Labour Party activist asked me to stand for Parliament in southwest London, in the Putney seat where my mum and dad were first put up by a friend,
mm-hmm.
because they didn't have anywhere to live, and then subsequently settled. They asked me to stand as a parliamentary candidate in 1980, and I was chosen in a contest to do so. And then I stood unsuccessfully. This was the height of the Thatcher period, and Labour was just being hammered.
Decimated,
as I'm afraid we are now. And then a friend said, after I'd lost twice in this kind of basically more conservative seat, you should try to find a seat where it's a better chance of winning. And I was fortunately in a contest of 30 people, mm-hmm. selected for the wonderful South Wales former coal mining area of Neath. Big rugby town, Neath. Founding place of the Welsh Rugby Union.
Right.
And so my selection was quite controversial because there were still people who didn't like me because of rugby.
Well, some people would also call it a sort of gerrymandering.
Well, it wasn't. It was open. It was an open selection. People tried to make that. But
Did they call them rotten boroughs or something?
It wasn't like that. It wasn't like that at all, Gareth.
I believe you.
I promise.
I believe you.
cheeky. Then there's the accusations you get parachuted in and all that stuff. Actually,
it happens. It happens all over the world. But in this case, you won it fair and square.
Fair and square, yeah. The contest of 30 people.
And also going into a completely strange place where you don't know anybody and then standing for office and getting the votes. Some would say that's harder than being in your home district.
It is, but I just felt a kind of affinity. And I think it's my South African background. I think if I'd been English, that would have been harder.
Hmm.
You know, somebody said to me, well, Peter, you may not be Welsh, but at least you're not bloody English.
All right.
It was said in jest, but, you know.
We've got lots to talk about, and I see we've only got about 25 minutes left of this, so I don't want to rush you, but I need to know what it was like to be in cabinet with Tony Blair at the – well, I mean, you were there for a fair period of time. You were involved in probably some of the discussions that are still – some of the most contentious discussions in British politics, even global politics, that involved the war in Iraq.
Absolutely.
That would have involved Afghanistan, that would have involved what happened subsequent to that in the Brown cabinet too. To be in that room when history is being written, it must be quite a scary thing at the same time as being exhilarating. Did you realize the historical significance of it at the time?
Yes, I think we all did. It was a fantastic privilege to be in government. That's the way I see it. I never expected to be there. I never expected to be an MP, nor a government minister, nor a senior cabinet minister. And there were some amazing things we did as a Labour government, and I just want to touch on those and then come back directly to address Iraq, which absolutely should be addressed. For example, I was privileged to be the cabinet minister who negotiated the settlement in Northern Ireland, which brought the old enemies together, the IRA.
Did you then have a lot to do with Mo Molem?
No, she was before me. She started the process off with Tony Blair in 1997. And in the period 2005 to 2007, I helped bring it all to a head and then negotiated with Tony Blair the final settlement that brought these warring enemies, literally warring enemies, to share government
together.
Decades. Well, going back centuries, a conflict going back centuries. So I'm very proud of things like that and privileged.
It should be.
And lots of other things as well, you know, that I managed to do right the way through my 12 years in government. The thing that haunts me and all of us, and it haunts Tony Blair too, is the Iraq episode. Because I honestly believe, people don't believe this, but I honestly believed, as did my cabinet colleagues, and I think Tony Blair did too, the weapons of mass destruction intelligence that we were briefed on And to be fair, most people did.
Mm.
You know, the foreign intelligence services of the world who opposed, like the French and the Russians, who opposed the invasion, also believed it. So, you know, that was why we took the decision we did, and cabinet ministers like me backed Tony Blair. It was a terrible mistake, however, and a tragic mistake, because those weapons of mass destruction did not exist. The American-driven follow-up aftermath was terrible, and we see the unfolding tragedies in the Middle East, that the rise of Islamic State, which is a bloodthirsty terrorist outfit, cannot be entirely attributed to Iraq, but is part of the picture.
It's almost the way you're describing it. It's almost the way someone who's been in a horrible car accident describes it afterwards, when they see the whole thing happening in slow motion in their head, and they replay it and replay it and replay it, wondering how they could have perhaps done it better. But it seems to me that, you know, there's nothing like hindsight. At the time, there was this man who was, for all intents and purposes, a warlord.
Well, absolutely.
A very nasty piece of work, who was running a family crime business.
Yes.
In the form of the state.
And
who had murdered savagely and chemically hundreds of thousands of Kurds.
Yes.
Who was an enemy of humanitarianism.
Absolutely.
At the very least, he was not someone who we can allow anyone to paint him as some sort of victim.
Completely. I totally agree, Gareth. I mean, this is the man who, in modern history at least, has killed more Muslims than anybody else.
Yes.
Remember the war against Iran?
Yes.
Hundreds of thousands
of
Iranians.
And it was a cynical war.
Completely.
It was completely unnecessary from both sides. And Saddam instigated it on two occasions very, very directly.
And his chemical attack on the Kurds at Al-Abja in the north and all of that.
And then his invasion of Kuwait, which was also just a power grab.
Invasion of Kuwait, his extermination of the Shiites in the marsh area of the south of Iraq,
and,
all of that. Nothing takes away from the fact that it was a tragic mistake.
Sure.
But you have to, and you're right to say this, you have to understand, people write that bit of out of history. He was a brutal tyrant.
Well, because he's gone, that party has no spokesperson anymore. So all we hear is people who think they could have done it better in the position you were in. You're going to have a soft landing with me. I thought the invasion of Iraq was a necessary thing at the time.
Mm.
And,
but you're quite unusual, Gareth.
I'm sure that you'll occasionally find people who will think it's right to argue with you about your role in the anti-apartheid movement.
Yep.
But I think they'll lose the argument. In this case, I think, given the information you had, and there's no reason to believe, you know, people think that Tony Blair and George W. Bush were just so desperate to go to war, and that all they wanted was a good old fight with the Muslim world. Which is not the case at all.
Not the case with Tony Blair.
No,
I mean, George Bush was more sort of warmongerish. Remember, it was after...
Hawkish,
certainly. And Tony Blair made the mistake of getting too close to him on that issue.
Relationship.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was right for him to be, especially after the Twin Towers attack by Al-Qaeda, it was right to him to be close to Bush and to be a friend, but I think he was too easily driven over Iraq. But, you know, the one thing I will say, and nobody may agree with me except possibly you, Gareth, that I think people like me acted with integrity. Now, I would say that, wouldn't I? We did genuinely believe the weapons of mass destruction. He was perhaps the most brutal tyrant of modern times, Saddam Hussein, for the reasons we've both discussed. And particularly, remember, it was Muslims he killed.
Mm.
He killed very few foreigners.
No, he wasn't interested in foreigners.
No, it was particularly Shia Muslims that he killed. He was a Sunni hardliner.
And you could say he was Sunni, but he was probably secular.
He was.
So to even bring, he was just not interested in people. He was interested in himself.
Power, absolutely.
Can I ask you about a couple of arcane things about being Leader of the House of Commons, and what kinds of things? Lord Privy Seal. What does that mean? When you're Lord Privy Seal, what sort of extra things do you have to do that you don't do as a normal MP?
I asked this question when I was made Leader of the House of Commons.
Because there's that old Churchill adage about sealed to the privy. And yes. And I'm sure you must have heard that 100 times.
I have. I said, what is this Lord Privy Seal thing? And they said, well, that's necessary for you to be paid as a cabinet minister. If you don't have that title, you can't, because the Leader of the Commons is not a Secretary of State of Education or Northern Ireland or Wales or Foreign Office or whatever. So it's a kind of part of the anachronistic British tradition and constitution, to be frank, like the House of Lords is as well.
It used to be, the man in the king's retinue who carried the seal.
Yes, and it still exists. And I had to take the seal. I was presented with it in a box to take to Buckingham Palace to be sworn in as a Lord Privy Seal and do the kind of kneeling and kissing of the Queen's hands as you do on these occasions.
And I judge by your facial expressions that you're not very charmed by anything monarchical.
No, I'm not. I actually like the Queen as a person, and I like individual members of the royal family like Prince Charles and, sorry to drop names, and Prince William and Prince Harry that I've met. But I'm not a monarchist. I never have been. And I think, you know, a lot of the ritual leaves a great deal to be desired. And I also think that as part of this kind of anachronistic edifice, I think the House of Lords should be elected. I think I should be elected, not appointed.
Well, isn't it almost there in any case? I mean, the old aristocracy are pretty much out of the building.
Well, yes, although the key person I had to go to see, as we all have to go to see before we're introduced to the House of Lords in a sort of ceremonial procedure. No, it's somebody called, who I'd never heard of before, Garter King of Arms.
Oh, yes. Okay. He's the head of the College of Arms.
Well, you're incredibly well-informed, Gareth, I must say. But he's one of the 25 Knights of the Templar that still exist in Britain, and including the clerk of the Parliament, the House of Lords clerk. And so this character who appeared out of nowhere is very civil and polite, who kind of prepared me, agreed the title and all of this. It was quite a... quite a business to go through, and
it's a bit of a genealogy on you.
That is the part of the whole thing that I didn't enjoy, but I am actually enjoying the freedom to speak. I'm speaking on Monday when I go back in the bill, the legislation on Brexit. I'm going to be speaking against that.
We've got 10 minutes. I've got to ask you about Brexit. I've got to ask you about where the Labour Party is at the moment, because it's in the doldrums. Do you think that the left in Europe is in very grave danger? Because obviously these things are cyclical. And it goes left, and then it goes a little bit right, and then it goes a little bit left and a little bit right. But it seems to me that in France, in Germany, in Britain, in Spain, in Portugal, in the Netherlands, all of these countries seem to be swinging slightly to the right, which for a leftist is very disturbing.
It is, especially when the form of right is not the traditional centrist conservatism of, say, Angela Merkel, or, you know, Pompidou in France or whoever it might be, Charles de Gaulle. It is a populist hard right.
Well, you could argue from their point of view that the populist hard left under people like Bernie Sanders in America, or the fact that many of the Labourites, certainly in the last crop of leadership, were very much going more left rather than centrist themselves, and it's an overreaction.
Well, I think it's more, I would take a different view. I think this represents a failure of the parliamentary left across Europe and in America, as we saw in the presidential elections, to offer an alternative to the kind of triple threats that people see to their lives, and those are austerity, globalization, and free trade. And the parliamentary left has kind of gone along with those things without providing a protective policy that supports many hundreds of millions of people who have lost out as a result of that. Now, when I say that, austerity and the cuts and shrinking the state after the banking crisis was absolutely counterproductive, in my view.
But necessary.
No, I don't think it was necessary. You don't think it was necessary? No, because I think what we should have done is we started to do in the Labour government and actually got the economy back on track after the worst crisis since since the big crash of the late 1920s, was to actually gradually invest to grow the economy. The way you get rid of high borrowing, the way you get rid of a high deficit, the way you get rid of national debt is to grow the economy. That's what we did after the Second World War. You know, Hitler, the war against Hitler left Britain with a debt double the size of even the one that we had after the banking crisis. And we didn't. We built the National Health Service. We built millions of houses under Conservative governments as well.
Well, it wasn't Clement Attlee.
Well, it was Clement Attlee who created the health service and started the house building. And so you got growth.
Yes. No,
and
sure.
Then we had...
I promise you I'm being facetious.
I know you are. I did think that. And then we got, Reagan and Thatcher changed all of that, that kind of Keynesianism of, yes. of full employment policies and investment and welfare to support those who needed supporting. And it became a neoliberal policy of you're all on your own, deregulate everything, market forces always must be introduced into everywhere, public is bad, private is good. And we've ended up with a banking crisis, we've ended up with gross inequality. If you look at the figures at Wits Business School, as I said, I'm visiting professor, I gave a lecture on Wednesday night showing the evidence that 90% of the richer countries, the places like Europe and America and so on, 90% of the population have actually lost out over the last 10, 20 years in relative incomes. The top 10% have done well, the top 1% have done very well, and the top 0.1% stratospherically well.
Yes, sure.
That is why you've had a revolt represented by Brexit, by Trump, and by all these populist forces
also,
like Le Pen in
isn't
France.
Isn't it also as a result of the left's
yes,
attempted
failure.
Social engineering some of the time? I don't mean it in a nasty sense. I just mean a lot of you're a victim of your own success in some way if you're on the left, because most of the ideas that were taken on as classical liberal ideas are now very mainstream.
They are,
by
and that's
and
not, a good thing.
Which is a victory.
You know,
and there's no such, there's no worse enemy for a politician than success in some ways.
No,
because
I don't
gives you nothing else to fight for.
No,
after
I don't
a while.
Agree with you at all. I mean, you deal with other injustices. You know, it's great that you've got equal opportunities as now.
Yeah, but then you start finding things like transgender bathrooms in America, which is a non-issue.
Well,
and it then makes people, ordinary people, go, is this all we have to talk about? I don't have a job.
Well,
you know what I mean? It kind of throws the argument
exactly.
into ridiculousness.
And that is where the left has failed.
Mm.
And if you're making that point, I agree with you. But
okay.
I don't think transgenders bathrooms come into it. I think the parliamentary left has failed to offer an alternative to policies that you can't stop globalization.
And immigration
has also been a big – the mass migration of people – especially into Europe, and in people who are coming for a better life.
Sure, which all of us understand.
Of course we do.
And
look at all the Africans who've come to South Africa for a better
absolutely.
Life.
Absolutely.
And that's caused its stresses. So this is a global phenomenon, and it's not going to stop. This is going to continue, and we have to find a way of governing, which means actually bigger government, not for its own
you think
sake.
More statism.
Not statism, Gareth, but bigger, more active government to support investment in new jobs, the new technology. You know, I have an iPhone.
Mm.
The technology for the iPhone was not invented by the private sector. It was invented by an American government research grant. But Apple needed to bring it to the market. My point is you need active government.
Public-private partnerships.
Public-private partnerships.
Mm.
And you shouldn't shrink the state. You should actually provide the support for a successful business community.
Brexit obviously is a big disappointment to you.
Yes.
But this is what the people of Britain want. See, this is where I get a little confused.
Mm.
And I by no means am pegging my colors to the mast on this. I wish I'd taken a bet on Brexit. I would have won money. Because nobody expected this.
No.
So the idea is that we want democracy, which is the people's will. But then we have these people who say, well, the people don't really know what's best for them some of the time. And in this case, it may be true. But you can't then claim to be democratic.
Well, first of all, I respect the outcome of the referendum.
Okay.
People voted 52% to 48%. But what I think the government should be doing, which is why I'm objecting and voting against the bill if I get a chance, and amending it
mm-hmm.
on two key things, staying in the single market, and which is Britain able to trade without any barriers or tariffs into the biggest, richest single market in the world.
Which would obviously make sense.
Yes. Yeah. And the second is to make sure the Northern Ireland peace process is not derailed by establishing a hard border. But what I think the government should be doing in Britain is pursuing a one-nation Brexit by recognizing that this was very close. 48% of people voted against. You cannot dispute the democratic outcome, but you should be doing it in a way that is inclusive, that is not going to be destructive of jobs and prosperity, which is what I think they're doing now. They're following, if you like, a Trump Brexit rather than a one-nation Brexit. And that's what I object to. And I think this is going to lead to a lot of economic dislocation, and it's going to take Britain further down the road of a low-tax, deregulated, neoconservative kind of right-wing type of Britain, which is going to make it much harder to create a fair society. That's what I object to.
Is the EU going to survive, in your opinion? Because there's no point in talking Brexit if the return, if there should be such a thing, is to nothing.
Well, I hope it'll survive. It's under great pressure by a combination of migration, by a combination of the euro's flaws, although it's been in some respects a huge success, by the fact that Britain leaving is going to be very destabilizing, because Britain's one of the biggest economies, one of the biggest contributors to the European budget, net contributors. That money's going to go, £10 billion of it, and that's a lot. And also this wave of right-wing populism. If Marine Le Pen wins in France in a few months' time, she will destabilize France, try to take France out of the euro. And by the way, on that, people told me Brexit wasn't going to happen. People told me Trump wasn't going to happen. Now they say Le Pen is not going to happen.
She may.
Which is why she may.
I've already seen an article just today saying Le Pen is Trump without the crazy, almost trying to make her sanitary.
Le Pen is hard right.
Yeah.
But she's running a very astute campaign. And when she has, and this is, goes to what we said earlier on, what we discussed, when she has former Communist Party working class voters, because the Communist Party used to be strong in France until quite recently, a very big part of the political landscape, some of them voting for Le Pen, you know, just like you've got Labour Party voters voting for Brexit and former registered Democrats voting for Trump.
Correct. And not even Democrats, but just working people in America who feel, you know, betrayed. Minorities even.
Or minors.
Yes. Correct. In Wales.
Wales and in Appalachia and in Pennsylvania voting for Trump.
Yeah.
You know, part of the union, part of the labor movement tradition.
Which is why he's pursuing this ridiculous energy policy that he seems to be by his appointments.
Indeed.
Anyway, look, I mean, because we're now out of time and I still wanted to talk to you about alternative medicine and a whole lot of other stuff that I'm sure you'd love to get into. There's lots of controversy there too.
I don't mind, but I think we've run out of time, Gareth. But look, it's been a great pleasure and a privilege being on your program.
No, it's terrific to talk to you, and thank you so much for coming to share some of that with us. I'm blown away by the story of Dikhang Mosinekye.
Yes, it is.
And I think that there's probably a lot that we could still talk about when it comes to things like Iraq.
Well, you know, when Wits Business School next bring me out in my visiting teaching role, and
how
I'm enjoying it.
For?
I go back on Sunday, but I'm enjoying it enormously because I'm teaching about leadership and things like that. Business people of the future or in the business community. And it's very exciting, actually.
People are able to attend lectures.
So I'll come back if you invite me when I'm next out.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for coming to South Africa, coming back to your home in so many ways. And it's always good to see someone who's done amazing things, not just here, but abroad, and who still comes back to visit us. It's good of you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. The Right Honourable the Lord Hayne.
Just Peter Gareth to you.
Very good to see you. And we will be back on Monday. Have an excellent weekend, blah, blah, blah. And we'll leave you in the hands of the Gas Comedy Podcast. CliffCentral.com.